The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
And you are very welcome to The Debrief, where we look back at some of the biggest stories of the week. And today I'm joined by author and political editor of the Sunday Times, Jennifer Bray, professor of political economy at UCD, Aidan Regan, and writer and columnist Deirdre Reynolds. You're all very welcome to the show. I'm going to start with you, Aidan, okay. Right? And I'm going to look at a tweet, two tweets that you put up this week, right? Ireland's primary schools are built for the single earner household. The economy moved on. The school day didn't. The second tweet, primary teaching is a part-time job, a beautiful and worthy one that should be well paid, but is part-time.
Yeah, the second tweet is probably a little bit unfair, you know.
I can't imagine that made you very popular at the school gates this week.
No, but the more serious point is that I think, as most parents will understand, like, if you don't have flexibility in your job, I don't know how people manage kids in primary school. I mean, the 1 o'clock finish for kind of younger kids, the 2 o'clock finish, you need to have a lot of flexibility, and you need to have obviously an after school system that's integrated. So the real issue here is that I think it is true that the primary school system is designed on the assumption that there's somebody at home, right? And that world doesn't really exist anymore. It's kind of designed on the assumption, typically, it's the woman at home. And we haven't really developed an integrated after school system.
So you don't necessarily think that the school day should be a little bit longer?
No, I think pedagogically the school day is probably about right for in terms of the kid in class teaching time. And it is true, for example, Irish teachers actually work more than the average OECD, whatever about the summers off and stuff, but they do work. And there's obviously a lot of emotional labour involved. But I think the best practice model, if you're looking at Sweden or Denmark or Germany, where you have a school system where you have, yes, you're in class pedagogical teaching of the kids, but it's integrated with the after school system. You know, there's a recognition that most people are working full time, so it has to be a continuous day, basically from 9 to 5, in the kids' best interest. We don't have that. It's a bit of a kind of, are you lucky enough to have the after school on site or not? You have to pick the kids up, you have to bring them somewhere else, or do you have to get a childminder? So we don't really have a proper integrated after school system. I think that's the big problem. They're kind of completely siloed. The school does one thing, the after school does something else. It's not like it's integrated into, well, what's in the best interest of the kids? How do we put together a proper program for kids during that period of time? So yeah, that's kind of the more point. I think teachers deserve to be very well paid and deserve their time off.
Is and it you don't think it's part-time?
Well, I mean, look, let's be honest. Like, if you have 2 or 3 months off a year, like, that's not full-time work. I don't mean that in any bad way. That's like, if you had 3 months off or 2 months off, would you consider yourself to be working full-time? Probably not, you know? And I don't mean it like, it's not meant to be a mean statement. It's just that actually it's quite a good job to have. It gives you a lot of flexibility. And come the summertime with the after school, with the summer camps, as I think we all know, it's that time of year where everybody's thinking, well, how do I get my kids? What am I going to do in July and August? Well, we have to get into the summer camps. But if you're a teacher, you don't really have that problem because you're at home with your kids. So I think it's good that we value our primary school system. It's good that we value our teachers, and it's good that we have that flexibility. But it is kind of prefaced on the assumption that there's somebody at home.
Jennifer?
I think you're such a brave man putting out a tweet like that. And also, you know yourself, even if you have like a nuanced set of lengthy tweets, the one thing people are going to remember is the part-time comment. I have a lot of friends who are teachers, and with the greatest of respect to you now, I just think that I really disagree with the statement. Not because I think it's a popular thing to say, but just because of the experiences of friends of mine who are teachers. And I think it is true that obviously it's much handier during the summer, but their experience during the school year is, from what I'm being told, there's a huge level of burnout.
Yeah.
And also, like, when you're a teacher nowadays, it seems you're not only just expected to be a teacher, you're also expected to be 10 other different kinds of things. And almost this kind of presumption, you'll also be a former babysitter or, you know, a counsellor. And there's all these extra things that are constantly being added on. And I just don't know if that's fully taken into account. And now we have kind of situations as well where, you know, there's a huge and rightful focus on special educational needs, but there are a lot of teachers who are taking on the administrative burden of that, particularly after school hours. So certainly the feedback I've received from friends who are teachers is that they're completely burnt out. They have all these additional duties. And I think one of the things someone said to me recently kind of made me sad was the joy of it sometimes can disappear. And I thought that was I thought I did think that was kind of sad to hear.
And class sizes are big as well. That's the thing.
That's true.
Irish
yeah,
class
and they
are.
Yeah. I think when people hear burnout, they think, yes, they appreciate how being within the shop, there is burnout happening. But there will be plenty of people saying, but you have lots of time to address that burnout with the time off.
No, I, along with Jen, I probably would respectfully disagree. And, you know, I was chatting about this with some teachers last night, and one of them sent me back a 19-minute voice note that is unairable. She so vehemently disagreed with the sentiment. But
you
I think
felt strongly about it?
Yeah, a little bit strongly. I suppose the issue was a lot of people, unfortunately, maybe read your follow-up tweet or X or whatever we're calling them now first, as I did. And I don't have any skin in the game because I don't have kids, but even my blood was boiling at that. And then when I went back and read your original message, I said, yeah, well, that obviously does make sense because the society has moved on. And for me, the only impact it really has on me is when I want to go to the gym in the morning, the classes are all kind of revolve around the school run. Yeah. So, and my commute to work, you know, the traffic revolves around the school run. But certainly, yeah, likewise, I have teacher friends who the amount of silent labour that they do, it's weekends, it's after hours, and I would worry as you say, Jen, that there is an expectation that teachers are now going to have to parent as well. Well, yeah. They already do, you know, they are effectively kind of being treated as childminders, I think, in some senses.
But we probably do need to distinguish between the primary and secondary system. Like I was talking about the primary school system, right, which is distinct. Like the secondary school system, the amount of additional labour that you have to put in is quite significant. Mm. And you're dealing with a lot of social issues as well because you're dealing with young adolescents and teenagers. But like, you know, I think at the primary level, where it's kind of 9-to-1 basically for junior, senior infants, I'm not saying that the teachers don't have extra work to do after that 1 o'clock, but it's nothing compared to dealing with, say, six-year students in the secondary system.
You know? Okay. I'd take teenagers over young children any time, I'm afraid. Not if you added a zero to the amount the primary school teachers get paid, would you pay me to do it? Honestly, it's such a tough job, and I just so much respect for it. And it's different nowadays, because like when we were in primary school, and we're all probably of a similar vintage, there wasn't as much kind of focus on the individual child as well. You were kind of almost rote learning out of a book. It's just so different now. So you're right to say the system has completely moved on.
Okay, but to the wider point, Jennifer, I think that Aidan was making there, that we need to sort of redesign the whole school system to reflect the reality of what an adult schedule looks like these days. Do you agree with that?
I do. Yeah, I agree with the sentiment behind that, because obviously, you know, like you said, things have moved on. And I think just in terms of like even the demands on teachers around the curriculum is completely different. And yeah, you're right about the after school thing, like the integrated idea. But I think we should always be open, really, shouldn't we, to kind of looking at that? But yeah, unfortunately, I think what people will remember is your comment about the part-time nature of the job.
All right, we might move on there so that you have a nice bank holiday weekend, Aidan, and don't find yourself the victim of some sort of abuse at the school gates this afternoon. We want to talk about the M50 because we had Brian Caulfield, the Professor of Transport from Trinity, on the Clare Byrne Show earlier this week, and he was talking about the M50, which we know is at capacity. I thankfully do not have to use it, but I don't know if any of you do here in the room. But what he was suggesting is that as a short-term fix, we might need to look at increasing the tolls, because he said the studies that he has done suggests that increasing the tolls means less people will use it. Agree or disagree, Aidan?
I disagree. And I disagree mainly because the lack of alternatives. If you have a good public transport system, a drop-in ride system, and people can genuinely have access and get around in an alternative means, then yes, whack the prices up to disincentivize people from using it. But we don't have that. So I would be curious. I mean, I obviously have a lot of respect for Brian's work and the research he's done. And if his research says actually increasing prices reduces traffic, I would be curious about the cities that he's talking about. And I suspect if you asked him to unpack that a bit further, I presume he would make the case for much more investment in public transport. So the priority really ought to be investing in public transport. The priority ought to be investing in the public infrastructure. The priority ought to be investing in like drop and ride systems, etc. And then when you have that in place, right, absolutely whack up the prices to get people off the road. But as a kind of first-time fix, and good luck to any government at this moment or point in time that is going to increase prices on what would disproportionately hit lower earners who are car dependent, and that is just not good politics at this moment.
But I suppose the problem here, Deirdre, is that we know commuters' quality of life is really genuinely being impacted by the amount of time they're having to spend commuting. And so the idea is that you know, as a short-term fix, because yes, we need the investment in public transport. Yes, we need to give people alternatives. But as a short-term fix, is there a way of trying to move some people out of their cars? I think 70% of the cars that are on the M50 in the morning are single occupants.
I just think, when in this country is anything ever short-term, though, it's really difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube if you start whacking on these charges. I'm a commuter myself. I don't use the M50 so much, but I use the M3. To get here today, you know, 184 times, because I hit two tolls on the way. I'm based in Meath. If I want to go Southside, if I need to go to the Beacon Hospital, for argument's sake, then I've got 180 times four, 260 times two. You do the maths, I'm not great at maths. Along with my fuel costs, parking and all the other things on top of it. A thing that annoys me, I suppose, in this argument...
You're talking possibly 20 quid on tolls
easily,
and parking alone?
Easily. To the point where I have to consider... And I'm not a particularly heavy road user. I suppose I'd be considered moderate to heavy, but I'm not like on the road every day. I maybe go to the office three times a week. But we're not clogging up motorways for the crack. And there's like this idea that people are stuck in traffic for leisure. I mean, these are trips that are made out of necessity. I looked at my eFlow bill before I come in here. €163.66 so far will be on my next bill. So it's not like Netflix or Audible where I can choose to get rid of those. And I totally agree, obviously, about public transport. I'm in an area where I do not have the option of either a bus or a train. I would have to drive to even get the bus, and then I'd have to park my car up for the day, or I'd have to maybe drive, get a bus, get a train. You know, I'm not on a connected route. So there's that issue. And also, I do think for women as well, there's an issue of safety, because I work on Talbot Street. Even though we're constantly being told by minister after minister that Dublin is a safe city, if I want to get from my home to work, first of all, it's more time efficient to hop in the car. And second of all, it's safer, because I'm not going to be hanging around Talbot Street or Bus Horace at night, or walking up to O'Connell Street to get a bus. I'm sorry.
What do you think, Jennifer, is the short term fix here? Or is there a short term fix? Or do we just have to accept, look, the M50 is congested. We knew there was going to be capacity issues. We were reaching max capacity a number of years ago. We thankfully had COVID. Well, not thankfully had COVID, but, you know, it actually bought you a couple of years, and we had the whole culture of working from home. It bought the government a bit more time, but they didn't do anything really to address the capacity issues. So my question is there a short term fix here?
I don't think there is a short term fix. And I don't like the way often conversations about how to address things always seem to end up in consumers paying more. It's always, okay, pay more, pay more. Everything costs more. Every single bill, everything. It's always, that's all. And it's not the answer, particularly when people are already so hard pressed. I mean, I've just come off a week of covering the different debates in the Dáil about the cost of living and the stories that the different TDs are bringing into the Dáil about people being forced to choose between, you know, their heating and their food and stuff. So people are already right up against it. And I think adding more costs on is not the answer. The way I look at it is a longer term thing, and it depresses the life out of me, because the answer is things like the Metrolink. And it really, really is so frustrating when you hear, when it's the same conversation year after year about we're in this part of the process, we're now we're held up. Okay, now we're in the next part of the process, now we're held up.
There a way to try and encourage more carpooling, for example, Aidan, or more park and ride facilities? Could that be something that we address? Do you think people have the appetite for that?
I suspect they would. But again, it's a bit like...
We're not
like
great carpoolers in this country.
No.
I don't think we really have a culture of it, to be honest.
I mean, even like in UCD, where I work, sometimes you'd be I'd be on the bicycle, let's say, and you're leaving the university, and there'd be a line of cars, and you could have 40, 50 cars in a row, and there'd be one person per car going nowhere. So it's completely inefficient. It's completely irrational, quite frankly. And then the question is, there's lots of people in those cars that could quite easily pool or do have an alternative. There's always going to be a case where people don't have a choice, and that has to be accommodated. But the reality is, in Ireland, in Dublin in particular, I think it's 70% of journeys are within a 2.5 kilometre radius. You know, people are very car dependent, and it's a culture, and it's a culture that is quite unique to the English speaking world. You don't have that culture in most European cities, mainly because there's a culture of using good quality, effective and efficient public transport, or using the most efficient piece of technology we've ever invented, which is the bicycle. You know, so there is this kind of attachment to the car in Ireland, which I think is a problem. Does increasing prices do disincentivize people to get into their car address that? I don't think so. It just annoys people. We really have to think long term about developing an efficient alternative.
But is that about people then taking some responsibility?
Yeah, it's a bit like
for this themselves. I know you say don't blame the consumers, but what you're kind of saying is, Aidan, a lot of these are short journeys. You mightn't be able to do them out in rural Ireland, but actually in the city, you possibly can.
Yeah, I'm going
to
get myself into big trouble now. Talk about teachers
coming for the coaches now.
Teachers and people who use their car. But like, yes, like the reality is, yes, there is an over dependence on the car. I mean, I'm out in Greystones now. And like in the school run, I dropped my son off on the bicycle. And then the whole street is just full of cars, back to back, back to back. One person per car, a 2.5 ton vehicle carrying a 20 kilo load. It's completely inefficient. And there is an alternative to that. Walk, take the bike. But of course, if you say that in Ireland, people get, oh, you're just...
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to start a Leo-style urban-rural argument here, because we're all friends now again after that. But disproportionately, it is country dwellers that are affected by this. Yeah. And it's a lovely idea that the roads are going to be equitable. And, you know, as the professor that was on yesterday said, we'll share the love by, you know, scattering the tolls. But I mean, I'd say that's share the pain, not share the love.
Okay, let's move on to something a little lighter, seeing as it is the Friday of a bank holiday weekend, and hopefully lots of us will be heading out for a bite to eat with family over the weekend. It was this research they were discussing on the programme earlier in the week that stolen food just tastes better. Jennifer?
It does.
Are you a food robber?
I am. Like my, name and my husband, yes. When he makes his dinner, he just makes really nice chips. And I'm always like, oh, give me one. I'll just take one. And then I'm lingering over his shoulder and he's looking at me going, do you want some?
But she's also a feeder, because she was giving us fruit pastilles out in the waiting
room. I forgot to have breakfast. So I had some fruit pastilles. But and I think part of it because is the reason around scarcity. You know, if it's someone else's food, you know, you can't have it all. So the little bite tastes better as well. Also, you probably didn't make it yourself. So that's always nice too.
You, Aidan, I think you said you are a bit of a food stealer, are you?
Oh, I would steal off other people's plate for sure. Always have done. There's always a competition when I was a kid who gets the biggest piece of meat on the plate, you know. But no, I mean, does it taste better? I'm interested in the psychology behind it. I would be curious to see this study. What is it about the brain that makes us feel and think that the food is better when we take it from somebody else's plate? It's probably just the inner rebelliousness in us all, you know.
When they did the study, they actually did it. First of all, they did it in a controlled environment, so I don't advise anybody doing this in a restaurant because you get the hand taken off you. But they did actually find exactly that it was the kind of moral transgression, the boldness of it. It was nothing to do with the chips didn't taste any better, but just that kind of the phrase guilty pleasure, I suppose, sums it up. Now, it was a Russian study, so I do wonder what type of chips they were using, because you know, I might do time for a chipper chip, but I'm not going to be bothered with a skinny fry, you know.
I think there's a bit about the deprivation. That's when I rob food, because I'm trying not to eat the chips.
Yeah, so true.
Basically.
Yeah, you're trying to be good.
Always, always, always. And so that's why when you have the little stolen one off, generally my husband's plate, God help.
Yeah, I think we've all been in those situations where, oh no, I'm going to order the salad, not the chips. You get the chips. The chips come to the other person. Like, I'll just take your chips as well. Like,
you
know?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Do you know what this weekend? Let's all order our own chips.
Seagulls have been onto something all along.
None of this guilty pleasure. Talk. All right, we're going to have to leave that there for now. My thanks to Jennifer Bray, to Aidan Regan and to Deirdre Reynolds. My thanks to all of you for getting in touch with us on the show today. If you've missed anything, you can listen back on the Go Loud app. Just enough time to tell you that Michael Wisely from Dublin is the winner of our 2-night stay in the Grace Westport Estate. He knew that the voice we played earlier was Jimmy Kimmel. Congratulations to you. Thanks to my team today, Cormac McDonough on sound, producers Alex Russo, Helena O'Toole and Dee King, with research by David O'Connor, and your broadcast assistant was Anne-Marie King.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.